This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may dwell. I have a very special program today. We have with us a guest, a lady who's quite knowledgeable on the situation facing European mankind. She's just written an article recently on the situation in South Africa. She has lived in Africa for a number of years, and she's very familiar with the situation. She's done a lot of research on the issue, and her name is Anne. And she's also very fit to commentate on the issues going on here in Sweden. We had a very, very fine festival last evening with a number of white nationalist groups convening here in Sweden. It was very successful, and I think a very inspiring event. We even had some excitement because apparently the police informed us that there were a couple of timed explosive devices left at one of our gathering points. Fortunately for our people, that these explosive devices did not go off. So there's never any lack for excitement in the movement, but it's amazing how the media tries to maintain that we're the terrorists, when the truth is I've always spoken against violence. There's not a drop of blood in my hands, as I mentioned last night in my speech. It's kind of ironic here in Stockholm, Sweden, Menachem Begin, who was the mass murderer at Deir Yassin, and who was certainly responsible for the bombing of the King David Hotel, kind of a mini 9/11. He was given a Nobel Peace Prize and welcomed as a hero. Nelson Mandela, who was involved in terrorism in Africa, including bombing of shopping centers and schools and the rest of it, he is now considered to be a great hero. But here I am, a man with not a drop of blood, not one member of my organization. Of course, that people confuse so-called Klan groups. Not one member of my organization, when I was involved in that group years and years ago, was ever charged or even accused of any sort of crime against a minority. There's not a drop of blood on these hands as I speak. But it seems that you read the media that, when I come to town, it seems Satan approaches, if that's the way to put it. But the people here realize that our cause is not about hatred of others. It's not about violence. It's certainly a rejection of those things. We don't want to see our nation become violent. We don't want to see the crime increased. We see the rapes and abuses of women that take place in a lot of the third world nations that seem to be visiting now Europe and America. So we have a real concern about those things. And the reason why we're active is not because of some sort of latent or intensive hatred against minorities, but because we have a lot of love for our own kind. And Anne is a writer who has expressed that love for our people and the concern for our people many times. And it's a pleasure to have you here with us. And please introduce yourself for our listening audience.
Okay. Hello. My name is Anne. And, I'm honored to be here with you, David.
How did you enjoy this festival yesterday?
I thought it was great. Yeah, it's just nice to see a lot of Swedish people coming together and having a good time. And having a lot of really interesting speakers to listen to as well.
I appreciate you doing this interview in English. obviously a second language for you. And
I used to go to an American school when I was a child. So.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, well,
some of the accent left.
you speak excellently. I wish all Americans spoke as well as you speak.
Thank you.
So I know that you read my book, Jewish Supremacism.
Yes.
Did it have a pretty big impact on you?
It did. I'm quite new to the movement. I've been involved since around 2002. And I wasn't aware of this issue, and I've become aware. And one of the things that made me taught me more about this was your book.
Yeah, Jewish. Pretty shocking for most people.
It was very shocking for me because I've been brought up with totally different views on this subject, and it's hard to realize that it might not be the way that I was taught in school.
What was the most, if you had to say it, what was the most shocking aspect of what you learned, and what hit you the hardest when you read the book?
Maybe the view of other people, the view of other people of us of white people. Or maybe it's like the Talmud and how they describe white people. And
you mean the Jewish view toward us?
Yes, I'm finding it hard to even use the word.
You're doing great.
Because I'm that was quite shocking to me that they were actually that's the way another group of people might view us that way.
Mm-hmm. I mean the true racial supremacism and racial hatred that we never hear about. I don't think is mm-hmm. I've been around the movement for a long time.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of the Swedish leaders, American leaders, British leaders, and French leaders, and not one of them speaks with the hatred or the vile, anger that these Jewish supremacists speak about Gentiles.
Mm. It was quite scary to read it.
It was. Yeah. You just recently wrote an article, a very well-researched article about South Africa and what's happening in that nation. Could you tell us about the article and some of your impressions of what's going on down there?
Yeah, well, I wrote the article was because I was doing some articles on Zimbabwe, and I'm much more aware of the situation in Zimbabwe because I have friends living there. And while I was researching, I found a webpage with a lot of pictures where you could crime scene forensic pictures from South African police on showing white people having been murdered, and these were farmers in South Africa from the Boer Afrikaner community, and I did not know about this because no media in Sweden would has to my knowledge ever written about this. And as far as I know, there are over 1,600 Boer Afrikaner farmers have been murdered in South Africa since 1994.
Yeah, you're saying 1,600?
Yeah, and brutally murdered and tortured, raped, really horrific type of murders.
Tell us about one of the cases that comes to mind in your research, one of the more... one of the typical kinds of cases that have occurred and who the victims were and what happened.
Yeah, I can tell you one case, but I have to mention a name then because this is was originally reported by a journalist called Anthony Lowe's. I can't pronounce his last name, but Anthony Lowe's Sibaido or Lobaido.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote about two old farmers, a married couple, and the husband was called Johan Lagrange. And they were at home, and when they were attacked by eight black South Africans, and they were on their farm of little small farm holding. They didn't even own the farm. They hired it,
mm-hmm.
and they had no means of defending themselves. And these eight men brutally tortured them and then pulled out their nails, burned them all over their bodies with hot irons, and then when they were finished, they thought these two old people were dead. But then they left for another house on the same farm where the old couple's daughter was living with her two small children. And unfortunately, she saw these men coming, and she was able to hide one of the children, a small infant, but she unfortunately wasn't able to hide her 4-year-old daughter. So they were tied up and molested and raped and tortured for hours, but they managed to survive. And but unfortunately, Johan Lagrange, who was in his 80s, he didn't survive the attack, so he died. And he was, I think, the 1,018th victim of the Boer Afrikaner community.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife survived, but I mean, she was left scarred for life.
That's unbelievable. This is almost a common occurrence now in Africa.
Yeah, it's a threat that the farmer community have to live with every day.
And also, there was a picture in your article. I'd like to find see if we can post that picture eventually of a quite beautiful, almost angelic, blonde, blue-eyed white girl who had suffered very severe injuries.
What
was her name? Do you remember?
I don't know her name. It's a picture from a poster from the by the South African police,
mm-hmm.
And she was, I think, about 4 or 5 years old, and she had been both brutally beaten and raped as well. And she had horrific injuries. And
well, they have a picture of her face in the
publication. We only show there are pictures where you can see her body and the mm-hmm. wounds as well, but we didn't really want to show them. And I think the look in her battered face, because she's blue all over her face and her eyes are red, the white of her eyes are all red, mm-hmm. and it's just the look in her face, all the suffering that she's been through. And I think that picture tells more than if you see. And also, out of respect for this girl, we didn't want to show the body.
Well, please send us a copy of that photograph digitally, and we'll get it up on the website.
Yeah. I'm sure I'm in contact with a lot of organizations both in South Africa and out of South Africa, and they use these pictures, and they'd be happy to help with this. And may I please just mention three people who helped me with this? It's Jan Lamprecht of African Crisis and Adriana Stuich of Sansterbach Beer in Holland,
mm-hmm.
and also Debbie Wren at Stop Boer Genocide in England and Britain. And these people are working every day to bring this bring awareness to what's happening to the white community and the Boer community in South Africa. And they helped me a lot, and without them, I wouldn't have been able to move to write the article.
There's really been a blackout in the world press about this.
And the interesting thing in Sweden is that when the white farmers of Zimbabwe were taken away, had the farms taken away by the land grab in Zimbabwe, the Swedish media wrote about that because one of these white Zimbabwean farmers was married to a Swedish woman,
mm-hmm.
and I'm sure that's the only reason we heard anything about that. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, I think there were about 12 white farmers murdered in Zimbabwe, and that caused quite a stir in the national media. But why isn't anyone writing or telling about what's happening to the white farmers of South Africa?
Because I guess South Africa is this great egalitarian democracy, and there's so much peace, love, and justice.
Yeah.
I mean, you have this man who is an open communist terrorist.
He actually went to school in Moscow during the Soviet mm-hmm. Union. He went to the Lenin school.
And of course, you have. There was a lot of, back to the Jewish supremacist issue, a lot of Jewish supremacist influence in this whole transfer of power in South Africa.
Yeah.
For instance, Major Slovo, or Colonel Slovo, who was a Jewish KGB officer, in fact, who was one of the leaders of the ANC.
Mm.
That's correct, isn't it?
I'm not so familiar with that, but I recognize the name on the...
Joe Slovo. And if you take a look at the media in South Africa, it's just like the media in Sweden, just like the media in America.
Very much
the media that promoted the end of apartheid, saying that, well, we've got to end apartheid because then everything's going to be safe and sound and secure, and we won't have this conflict, and everything will work out. Mm. And
well, I'll have to say that Adriana Stuich at Sansterbach Beer, who I interviewed, she said a very interesting thing. She said that this is the first time in history that black are ruling white, and she said, look what they're doing to them, they're killing them.
Large numbers, of course, many other African nations that's happened, but this is the only case.
This is the, I think it's only also where it's sort of called a
millions.
Democracy,
and
there are millions of, and there's also a multiculture, because I mean there are different races living in South Africa.
And of course, what has been the experience in Zimbabwe? I mean, you have friends there, could you tell us something about what's happening there in terms of the rights of the farmers and the people, and what's happened to the quality of life there?
I saw a number. I think there are about 50,000 white people living now in Zimbabwe,
mm-hmm.
and I think I don't really know. I don't think the situation for white people is similar to, because most of them are diplomats, and the people I know are not farmers in Zimbabwe. They moved from there, but I think in Zimbabwe it's mostly a problem for the black. Because I mean, there are different black groups in Zimbabwe, and it's Robert Mugabe is from one group, and it's mainly a problem between he's a terrorist also towards black, not just whites. So.
And as the white farmers are dispossessed and murdered and
pushed
out of the country.
Yeah.
What's happening to the food supply? I mean,
people are
starving right now, right?
Yeah, they are. I mean,
blacks as well.
I think it's about between 4 and 7 million people are mm-hmm. facing starvation in Zimbabwe, and it's going to be the same in South Africa, because I mean, there in South Africa there are about, I think there are less now than, it's diminishing every day. 35,000 white commercial farmers left. and they are supporting a whole nation of 45 million people. They farm on about 6% of the land,
mm-hmm.
but still the communist government and even the international media, they claim that the white people and the white farmers of South Africa, they own like 87% of the country. They farm 87% of the country, and it's a lie. It's not true. They have written about this on their webpage that they farm on about 6% of the country's area.
And they produce probably 85% of the
yeah, but I mean
farm
even
product.
Yeah, but even, I mean both South Africa and Zimbabwe were huge producers of farm crop products.
Mm-hmm.
And exported them, but now they have to import food.
You know, I've spent some time in South Africa. I did Radio Free South Africa. I traveled around the country, and I think it's important for our listeners to realize some of the facts that people don't know about South Africa. You know,
mm-hmm.
I always like to compare it with what's going on in Israel. I mean, when South Africa existed as an apartheid state, we had separate lands for Africans mm-hmm. and separate for whites, and a separate society. It was extremely condemned by the Jewish supremacist media. In fact, they organized boycotts against it. Not only did we not send South Africa any money, we basically put it on the no-trade zone and trade sanctions against South Africa. We did everything we could to destroy the economy of South Africa, and there was this constant, just massive hatred against the South Africans. But people don't really realize the history of the country, and I want to give a little short history, and you can comment on this as well. South Africa was not the kind of situation that happened when the Jewish refugees and so forth moved into Israel. What is now Israel was, in fact, Palestine. It was a well-populated country. They had farms, villages. They produced much of the world's oranges, certainly Europe's supply of oranges and citrus fruits. They had a long history. They lived there for literally hundreds of generations from ancient history. And these people were the Israelis, or the Jews came into this country. They literally terrorized the people, drove them off their land, and excluded them from the place of their birth, from their homes, their businesses, their farms. You have an entirely different situation that took place in South Africa when the Boers mm-hmm. came up to the Transvaal, for instance, and deep into South Africa. The land was basically vacant. There is nobody there. There are a few Hottentots.
I think there were when they arrived there, there were the Khoisan people who were migrating people.
That's right.
But the Bantus came from the north, and
exactly.
they did not arrive. I think they arrived in, and this you can read in the U.S. State, or even the U.S. State Department have written about
there,
this.
There was a handful of Hottentots, but basically it was a vacant land, yeah. And again, they didn't terrorize people. They didn't push them off. They didn't say you can't come back in. They didn't push them over the border. Later, what happened was what the demographic change took place in Africa, because blacks flooded in, including a lot of the Bantus, including the Zulus, and so they flooded into South Africa to enjoy the benefits that European civilization brought, the educational benefits, the opportunity existed for work, the opportunities existed to better sanitation, better medicine, and they came in as usual with a very, very high birth rate. And eventually they outbirthed and they out-immigrated the whites, and then whites eventually became a minority. So it wasn't quite as cut and dry as people would like to say.
No.
The situation actually in the takeover of Israel was far more just blatant, theft of people's land and suppression. The Israeli government, according to Mr. Greenberg, New York Times, tortures about 600 or 700 Palestinians every month. Torture was not the rule, in South Africa. And if they find one or two exceptions to that rule, that's possible. But torture is almost the rule in Israel. And Israel, of course, is just as segregated as South Africa ever was. In fact, South Africa dropped a lot of the segregation rules before the transfer of power, whereas Israel still is heavily segregated in housing and schools, and settlements. So the hypocrisy is rampant. South Africa even dropped some of its requirements about intermarriage.
Mm-hmm. And I think Adriana Stewart, who worked as a journalist in South Africa, she told me that during apartheid, there were millions of Africans from other countries who were trying to get into South Africa because they wanted to have the benefits that a white rule would, that meant even to them. So if apartheid was so horrible, why were all these millions standing outside the borders trying to get in, you know, trying to swim across rivers full of crocodiles to get into South Africa?
And, of course, conditions are deteriorating every day. The crime is South Africa now. Johannesburg went from one of the safest cities in the world to the, I think they have the highest crime rate now of any city in the world.
One of the most dangerous countries in the world.
And the beds, the hospitals used to be well kept for both whites and blacks. Now it's hard to find a clean sheet in a hospital for someone who's sick. Of course, the educational system has terribly suffered, you know, over the transition. The economic well-being of the people has suffered tremendously. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, we have a really egregious
standard. Yeah, I forgot to mention that there's, I mean, I should have mentioned right at the start, I mean, there's a genocide going on. There's an actual genocide going on in South Africa against the Boer Afrikaner community.
Well, ultimately, it amounts to a term that people use about certain lands where it's politically correct to use this term, but they don't use about it. They don't use it for things like in South Africa. South Africa and Zimbabwe are being ethnically cleansed of Europeans.
Yes,
there's
they are.
Ethnic cleansing going on.
Yes, they are.
And this is supposed to be the great evil, right? I mean, isn't this what we sent in troops and bombs and so forth into the former Yugoslavia?
Mm.
Because ethnic cleansing was going on. Of course, a lot of that was lies, by the way, too, by the globalists. But right now, this incredible population, these millions of Afrikaners and other people of English descent in South Africa who built this fantastic country, modern office buildings, businesses, works of art and education and medicine, and they're being literally ethnically cleansed from the nation that they created.
Yeah, there's a whole culture being extinguished from this earth. They're changing the names of cities that were built by the Afrikaners.
Well, that's happening in Louisiana, and in fact, in America. In the city of New Orleans, they recently took George Washington's name off a public school because they said he was an immoral example for the children. Of course, that's the father of my country.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of cultural change that's going on around the world.
Mm.
Let's change. Is there anything else you want to comment about in terms of South Africa or
before
we go on to Sweden?
Yeah, just the people who have to be, most people who are involved in the movement in Sweden are already aware of this, but people have to know that the same people who are who brought the ANC to power in South Africa and who are not writing about who are forcing, I mean, keeping the news of what's happening in South Africa out of our media.
Mm-hmm.
These are the same people who are pushing multiculturalness in Europe and Sweden, and who are also hushing what the negative effects of multiculture in Europe and Sweden. These are the same. They're even the same people.
And it's the same people who.
So,
apartheid, the same people who support Israel. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, I mean, and so what's happening in Africa? It's a possible future for all European nations if people don't wake up and realize that they have to take some action against this.
Well, that's right, and so then that's a perfect entree, I think, in discussing some of Sweden.
Yeah,
and it's. I know it's difficult for people to understand this, especially for Americans who have this image of Sweden of the golden hair, blue eyed goddesses that exist here, and the great Viking nation that it was. It's a very small populated land, by the way. What is the population of Sweden today?
I think it's about 9 million.
Yeah, that's which is just a tiny number of people, really, in terms of the world.
Mm.
Norway also has a very low population.
Mm-hmm.
And Denmark, of course, does. So your Nordic countries have a very small population, and yet you have massive immigration, and you have an incredible population change. Just, 25 years ago, there were literally no non-Swedes here.
Since 1980, and these are actual figures from our government, since 1980 we have had about almost 900,000 foreign people moving here, and then you have to, this is 1980, so you have to think about, it's not just 900,000 people, it's their children, their grandchildren also. So there are quite a lot of foreign people.
And they have a much higher birth rate than
Oh yes.
Incredibly higher.
Mm.
So what does this mean? I mean, this Is it correct then to say that this means eventually that what's happening in South Africa to those people and Rhodesia could actually happen in our own homeland of
Sweden? It is happening already. Plus, when I spoke to the people in South Africa, because the problem is that we have to get these white people out of South Africa and move them to either Europe or America, and people have to get involved with this, because otherwise they will die. And I told them, you know, I would really like for the Afrikaners, if they could come to Sweden, they would be most welcome. And these are people who work hard and who have built a great society there. But I also told them that as Sweden is today, we will not be able to protect you from some of the things that are happening to you in South Africa, because some of these things in a smaller scale, but still are happening in Sweden as well. I mean, farmers are being murdered in Sweden by immigrants. There was
smaller scale than South Africa.
Yeah,
but it's
starting. I mean, it has started and it's escalating. Mm-hmm. Like rape statistics and
gang rape was never a factor really in Swedish history until now.
We didn't really have a word. I don't think I ever heard a word before the 1990 sometime. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's happened in history in other countries as well, but we would consider people like that to be mentally ill, and it's a very rare thing. It's a very rare thing. Mm-hmm. But now it's a weekly occurrence. It happens every week in Sweden.
And if you oppose it, they say we're the ones who don't care about human rights, human dignity, and civil rights. And yet the people who are creating a system whereby women and young girls, 13, 14, 15 mm-hmm. years old, get gang raped, often yeah. brutalized, murdered, that create this kind of system where this is possible, they're the ones that are called people of love and brotherhood, right?
Yeah, because if you complain about they're actually organizations and officials and Swedish officials saying that the immigrants that are part of these gang rapes, they do it because of the Swedes' structure. In Sweden, it's called structural racism. Because of the racism that's built into society.
So they're admitting basically their motivation is hatred. They're hatred against us for whatever. They say it's justified hatred, but whatever it is, they're admitting that the rapes are based on hatred.
Yeah.
Racial hatred.
Yeah.
But we don't get any outcry from the media, do we, about that here?
No.
It's, and you're a writer and you deal with lots of people and different strata, obviously, of Swedish society, and you know people in Africa and elsewhere around the world. How do we get over to people that we are literally facing in Sweden and the other European countries and the United States and mm-hmm. Canada and Australia and New Zealand and every place where Europeans dwell on this planet? How do we get over to them that we are literally facing a genocidal situation? That if Sweden can go from 0% non-whites to maybe perhaps between 10 and 15 to 20% non-whites in the space of 20 years, and the birth rates are still differential, what is the future? I mean, how long will it be till we're a small minority in our own country, and these people that have so much built-in hatred against us have the power in these countries? And by the way, what have the Swedish done against these people? They've done nothing but offer them a better standard of living than any country they've come from. More education, better medical care than they could have dreamed about, and how are they paying us back? You know, gang rapes? Is that some sort of justifiable system?
Muggings, robberies, and also lots of new laws that give immigrants the right to a job before Sweden, or the applying to a university before.
There's so-called affirmative action going on.
Well,
here
it's not
too,
it's
huh?
not allowed yet, but it's. I mean, I it's going on. It's not legally allowed, but it's.
They're discriminating against Swedish citizens in favor of non-Swedish. And how about you've always had a very liberal welfare program here and high taxes in Sweden. Mm-hmm. And Sweden seemed to thrive pretty well under the system because so many people did work and were responsible.
Yeah.
But what is it like now? I mean,
well, I can tell you, we wrote an article in a magazine called Focus Nyheter, and it's but we heard that the social I think I don't know I'm sorry I don't know the word in English it's Department for Social Welfare perhaps might be might be a correct word. They were giving money to different projects to help against homelessness. And then we made some interviews, and almost all of these projects were geared towards immigrants, because immigrants, people of immigrant origin, are the fastest rising group among social welfare takers and homeless people in Sweden. But then when we made some interviews with the politicians in Malmö, which is Sweden's third largest city, and also which probably has the highest immigrant population in all of Sweden, old Swedish people, ethnic Swedish people, are being thrown out on the streets because they are forced to live at home. We don't have any money for old age housing, so they are forced to live alone at home, even if they're 85, 95 years old, and they're getting sick, they forget to pay the rent. And then there has actually been cases of ethnic Swedes being evicted from home, so they have now to give money from the Department of Social Welfare to the different cities, so they can house these people who are like in their 80s and 90s, they are the true backbone of Sweden, you know, because they have the true work morals. And they some of them, like my grandmother, sometime in her life she had like three jobs at the same
time. Struggled all their life.
Yeah, never trying to escape their duties or anything. And these people are actually now being thrown out in the street. Because and at the same time, Malmö's immigrant suburb is called the largest one is called Rosengård. They were 16 million Swedish crowns in the red last year. And someone is paying for this. And I think that maybe it's the old people who are paying for this.
That's right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of amazing, isn't it? I mean, here's Sweden, a country of 9 million people or so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And just a slight bit bigger than Louisiana. And yet, you know, you have Africa, and which is a huge continent, a continent of enormous resources and mm-hmm. wealth. As one person said, Thomas Dixon said so well, you know, it's a continent richer than a poet's fancy.
Mm. And it's a beautiful continent.
It's fantastic. Yeah. And 99%, in fact, 99.9% of the continent of Africa, under the Sahara anyway, is completely black. It's completely African.
Yeah.
And it's a very tiny white population in the very farthest of the south.
Mm.
And it's like... It's just amazing, you know. They've got all this continent, this tremendous wealth, natural resources, wide open spaces, different governments. They've got different choices of governments to live under, different kinds of environment and climates to live under. But we can't even have little nations like with 9 million people in it and preserve our way of life here. Mm. Now, the question is that fair? I mean, is there some sort of cosmic fairness to this?
It's amazing that Sweden is actually the sixth largest donor of money to South Africa. So, and I think we had disbursements of about two billion Swedish crowns last 2004.
So nine million people give money to tens of millions of
and we are so Africans. And one of the over 400 white Afrikaners in South Africa who are actually living below the welfare. I mean, they're starving. 400,000. Yeah, and at the same time as we are dispersing money to South Africa, South Africa has a law that these poor Afrikaners who have no place to go. And they cannot go to another country. They don't have the money, and they're not welcome because, I mean, they're white. So why would a white person want to seek asylum?
They can't even sell their property and leave the country.
They cannot. They don't. And these people, most of them, don't even have property because they have been laid off from work because they have these black empowerment laws. So
and let's make it clear: these are not people exploiters. Like the De Beer families and like some of the big Jewish concerns these men and women were people that came in, this average people from Europe, came into an
farmers.
Open country, they set up farms, they created a way of life, a beautiful way of life, and now literally they are being denied an existence. They are being genocided.
I believe also that it's important to note that the Afrikaners and Boers, they did not want to live in a multicultural society and apartheid. They wanted their own state. They want their own land. So, I mean, they don't want to live in a multicultural or be part of that. They want their own country, and they have a right to that. But they're denied it, and now they're being extinct. And I just wanted to say that it's so amazing that they're sending money from Sweden, but this money is not allowed to be dispersed to the poor whites in South Africa because they belong to a former privileged race group. So it's and we are still so. I mean, we are actually as Swedes with our tax money, we are actually helping with this genocide against the Boer and Afrikaner community.
Well, I believe that, and it's really tragic. And by the way, it never really has been the average, normal, middle-class European that's wanted some sort of segregation or some sort of a privilege over minorities. It's always been the richer classes, the so-called privileged classes, internationalists, you might say, the globalists. And in fact, in South Africa, the Jewish supremacists had enormous power economically. They're the ones who owned most of the diamond mines, by the way. They weren't even South Africans. They were basically Jews, and this is a fact. They controlled also many of the newspapers in South Africa, many of the financial institutions of that country. This is all true. And the South Africans did. They just wanted to live among themselves in their own state. But the reason why they wanted this integration multiculturalism is because these internationalist Jewish supremacists wanted to use the cheap labor the blacks could provide, because they knew that if they try to do that with the middle class white people and you don't pay them much, they're going to rise up and say, hey, this is not just. And so they had to they brought in, in fact, they didn't bring in, but they offered these jobs to massive numbers of blacks to come into the country at low wages. So it never really was really a product of the middle class European families in South Africa anyway. And now it's happening in a way in Sweden and in Norway and in Germany and England and Scotland and Ireland and France and Italy, Greece. It's happening in America and Europe. And it's inevitable that we will literally be wiped off the earth unless we make some great changes and show some great courage and honor in this fight. If you may have to make an appeal, Anne, to people on this issue, what would you say to them? What would you say to your brothers and sisters of our people to try to get them to wake up?
Well, let me first say that I really have to be very humble because I have been part of this movement for only 4 years, and there are so many people like in Sweden who have worked and been involved for so long, and I've seen these issues long before me. And so I feel very humbled that I should express something of an appeal, because I believe that there are a lot of people who would do it more eloquently than I can, and with more knowledge behind what they're saying. I feel that we have to start to feel some pride in ourselves, that we have we're all beautiful cultures, that we have an old beautiful heritage that is worth to preserving, and we have to start to feel some pride in ourselves, not pride built on prejudice against other groups and putting other people down, but it's just enough with us to see what our people have achieved. And it's just such a problem to reach people. And I think it's one problem might be that it's part of the European that we want to help, at least in Sweden, people really want to help people in need, and we feel the need that we have to be good, and we have to, if other people are suffering, we have to help them, even if it causes us our own extinction. But so you have to tell people that it's a good feeling, it's a good thing that you're feeling kind towards others, but you cannot take it so far that you could become extinct yourself. And that was my problem, because I used to be one of the good people, and I mean before before I went to live somewhere where there were no immigrants, and that was the reason why I got out of multiculture, because when I came back, and I could compare what it was like living in a multicultural and living in a mostly white Swedish area, then I realized how lovely that was and how nice that was. So I actually don't really have a good answer to that. I don't know why I became aware. But that's one part of it, that you have to be sort of, and maybe that's building our own societies, mm-hmm. and our own within the society, so that people can feel the calm and the how nice it is to live among your own people, compared to living in the multicultural.
Yeah, well, and this tape is being transcribed in a hotel room with a large mm-hmm. window overlooking beautiful lake and trees of the beautiful Swedish city called Linköping, I think.
Linköping.
Linköping. Yeah. You see there? My Swedish is not very good.
It's getting better.
and this is just a marvelous city. It's beautiful. The architecture, the streets are so clean. They have a very ecological sense here in mm-hmm. Sweden. There's very little pollution. They have many wonderful lakes here, yeah. which are the water you can practically drink from. It's just a beautiful society, and it's such a shame to see this society being deteriorated. It's mm-hmm. It hurts my heart to come to the homeland of our people as an American or a Canadian or Australian or whatever, to come back to our homelands and see even our homelands under attack. It's just... Yeah. It's crushing.
Yep, it hurts. It hurts every day to see
it. It hurts. But hopefully it motivates. And mm-hmm. I hope that everyone listening, and I hope that there's a lot of new people always that tune into this program, and I hope you realize that if you're of European descent, that your people have a right to live.
Yeah.
And I hope you realize that unless you act soon and intelligently and effectively and devote some of your life, your time, your money, your effort, that we're going to lose everything that's important on the planet. We're going to lose our culture, our civilization, our heritage, and our children will be bequeathed with a nightmare. One more thing. As you know, the police informed us about the terrorist attack upon us with explosive devices mm-hmm. that they left at the our meeting place.
One of the gathering places
for the meet against myself, against mm-hmm. the organization. And that's pretty scary, isn't it? I mean, I know that, and I think that the intention of what they were doing is not only to try to hurt people, but if they blew up something like that, to keep people away from our meetings in the future.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, anyone who's ever been in a city where there's been a big meeting with international government leaders or economic meetings and have seen these people actually, thrash whole cities, inner cities, and I've seen that, mm-hmm. they are capable of this. And apparently they believe that because they're not stopped, I think they're viewed upon as being the ace of the government mm-hmm. because they're not being stopped.
And of course, there's been a lot of silence about this. If there would have been a bomb mm-hmm. placed at a South African delegation or mm-hmm. some sort of Jewish organization, it simply failed to go off. That's what happened. It was a timed explosive device, and it mm-hmm. it failed to go off. It could have cost mm-hmm. lives, mm-hmm. carnage, damage, and there would have been a huge outcry. It had been a world story. It had been on the front page of every newspaper around the world.
Yeah.
And here it is. It's almost a silence, mm-hmm. ethnic blackout. I mean,
it's a shame. It's really shameful.
Well, it kind of shows you where we're going. I mean, mm-hmm. that our enemies really... They're not just talking about restricting our freedom of speech and taking away our freedom of association, our political mm-hmm. freedom. They really are very happy with wiping us out.
They
have no problem with that. In fact, they see that as a beautiful thing. It's kind of mm-hmm. like Professor Ignatieff at Harvard University, who says we must abolish the white race. Mm-hmm. These people feel that by wiping out white people, especially killing any white leaders or activists, that's somehow effective. But what I'm amazed is that there's so many people who are courageous. After we announced this to the crowd, what happened, with the bombs, mm-hmm. Nobody left. Nobody panicked at the meeting. People stayed all the way to the end, I think to probably 12 o'clock that evening.
Yeah.
And
we had a great meeting. I mean, we were just too smart for them.
And what a wonderful reception I received. And I want to thank you and all the people here for the fantastic reception you gave me, and I'm glad that you enjoyed, my talks last night.
We were happy to have you here, and as well as the other speakers. And we will continue to have these types of meetings and have these international. That's one thing that I think is very important, that we keep in contact in different countries, that we keep these international contacts, because we really need to work together to win, and we will.
And here you are, you know, a woman who's standing up and fighting, and you're brave. And some of those guys out there who are listening in the United States and some other parts of the world who are afraid to do anything, they should look to you as an example of courage. And I'm honored, really, to be with you today, interviewing you and interviewing the great people here in Sweden. It's been a wonderful experience for me. It always is in this country. I'm so thankful that there's a major and a vital movement that's growing here for your people, truly our people. And I hope to come back soon, and I hope to hear very soon of some real political gains and progress in this country. There are certainly many positive signs in this country and around the world, and I'm glad to be with you and to be on the cutting edge of this change.
Mm-hmm. We're so happy to have you here today.
Well, okay, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that's been another special edition of the David Duke Live Internet Worldwide Web Radio Program. And we will certainly have this posted for archive. And I think this is an excellent show, and I hope that all of you will give a lot of links to this program. I think this is an educational experience and an inspirational experience, this program, for people to understand what's going on in South Africa, what's going on in Sweden, how it applies to us. And to understand that the real essence of the struggle, and I'm editorializing a little bit at the end of this program, but this struggle is not some sort of intellectual exercise. It's not about whether you're right or not about the consistency of a cake you're baking, or whether you're going to accurately analyze an historical event. This is about flesh and blood. This is about people's survival, their well-being, even the existence of their very kind of life on this planet, and the higher ideals that we believe in. Multiculturalism has literally led around the world to the deaths of literally hundreds of thousands of our people around this planet. It has caused the murder or assault or robbery or criminal actions against millions of, even just in America, the figure is in the tens of millions who've been victims of this kind of assault. This is the reality of what we're fighting for. The massive immigration into Sweden and into America and into all these other countries will literally make us a tiny minority in our own nation and eventually threaten our very existence and that of our children. This is not a game. This is not some sort of intellectual exercise. This is the most important thing in the world. And I hope all of you will get it deep into your soul, deep into your heart, deep into your sinew, that unless you begin to give of yourself, sacrifice of yourself with your time, your effort, your money, and to bring out that courage and not be afraid, but to be strong and courageous as Anne has shown herself to be here, unless you're able to do that and willing to do that, we will lose the things that make life worth living. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm committed. The threats, the attempted bombing here, certainly does not lessen my resolve. It only increases it. It only enhances it. And it makes me more determined to do everything I can with the years I have left in my life, or even the weeks. I don't know. Who never knows when you have things like this happen. But it just makes me more determined to fight on. Thanks again, Anne, and I hope to interview you next time that I'm in Sweden, or when you're in America, or another country where I'm out there proselytizing for our people. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.